In today's episode, which is part of my intersectionality series, I talk about the whole self and the authentic self at work and in other parts of life. In this episode, I welcome my friend and colleague, Dr. Rochelle Johnson Benning. And I'm not only welcoming her to the podcast, but also to the Persuasion Point team. You're going to be hearing a lot more from Rochelle, not only in terms of her incredibly rich and varied background, her work experience, the different places in the world that she's lived, her very, very exciting career, the career changes that she's made. But in this episode and in the upcoming episode, she's going to be talking about how her experience has really given her this unique insight in terms of the intersectionality between the characteristics that we've talked about in previous episodes, how that connects not just with issues of mental health, she is a PhD in psychology, but also bringing in the intersectional components of what's going on in the world today with a pandemic raging around us, with issues related to the economy, racial strife. We bring this all together, and Rochelle helps us understand how that impacts our ability to keep drama out of our life. Drama, drama, drama. This is Patty Perez, and you're listening to the Drama Free Workplace podcast, where I combine the wisdom passed down to me by my drama-free Salvadoran parents with the lessons I've learned from nearly 30 years working as an attorney, workplace investigator, author, and speaker. We'll cover topics from faith to friendship, ethics to equity, bullying to bias, and everything in between. I throw in a dash of my Latina sass and bring my perspective as a mom, wife, daughter, and friend to make the serious topic of workplace conflict seem less daunting so that you can manage and resolve drama effectively. All right, welcome back to the podcast. And I am so excited to welcome my friend, my colleague, Rochelle Johnson Benning, who is going to be talking to us over the next few episodes, really about her passion and her expertise. It's the intersection of her incredibly interesting career that she's had over the last few decades. She started out doing one thing and has taken a lot of twists and turns. Rochelle and I first met because both of our husbands were stationed working in Mexico City. And that was, 20 years ago, Rochelle?
About 23.
yeah. It's been pre-kids, pre a lot of stuff happening.
We were in middle school.
Exactly. Yeah, child prodigies. But in any event, I've been following her not only as a friend, but in terms of her career. And so, Rochelle, welcome to the podcast. And what I'd love to just start out with is having you give us a synopsis of your journey as a professional. You end up where you are now, but boy, have you taken some interesting twists and turns along the way.
Yeah, thanks, Patty. I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me. So as Patty mentioned, my name is Dr. Rochelle Johnson Benning. I am a mental health professional. I have a doctorate in psychotherapy and counseling, and I have studied as a counseling psychologist. What I would describe myself best as an educator, a trainer, facilitator, and a coach. So Patty mentioned that I had a really long journey. It started off in television. We're talking 1990, when I worked as a producer and a journalist and a writer for about 15 years. And then I decided to go back to graduate school. And I wanted to take a class because I was very interested. I was doing health documentaries, and it turned into a doctorate and a whole new career. And so in the beginning of that career, we're looking at the end, like 2006, 2007, when I went back to grad school. I had all intentions in being a researcher and a therapist, but I kind of really liked looking at mental health as a holistic part of being as a physical health, and also kind of looking at it from a wellness model. So that's kind of where it led me more into doing more psychoeducational programs and also coaching. So that's what I'm currently doing right now, working as a consultant and doing webinars, doing writing and researching. I'm also teaching some graduate school classes, kind of concentrating on weird stuff like existential philosophy and human issues and developmental issues. So yeah, so as I talk about it, that's, I tried to just sum up about 25 years. So hopefully I did a good job doing
that. You did. And one thing is for sure, you definitely summarized one of the reasons that we are friends, and that is that we are fellow nerds. And I've always loved that about you, with nerds with a little bit of, you know, goofiness and sense of humor thrown into there. So a couple of things just before we get into the topic. So the series that we are in right now is about intersectionality. And I specifically am focusing, certainly we're talking about other characteristics that make up the whole of intersectionality, but the theory started by Professor Crenshaw really centers around Black women and women of color. And so because this is a podcast, people can't see you and they can't necessarily tell just by listening to you. The other thing that's fascinating about you is I don't even know if you're multiracial. You're like multiracial. So tell us a little bit about your background and maybe even, I think another thing that just brings this, who you are and the way in which you approach your work is the way that you grew up. And then that 25-year span that you were talking about, you've also lived all over the world. Tell us a little bit about that background.
I would identify myself as an African American, but I definitely come from a background where my family comes from quite a few countries in the Caribbean. We cover Spanish speaking and English speaking Caribbean. And also I have a grandparent from Denmark. And then one of my grandparents, I always like to say she was the original Kamala Harris. She was half Indian and half West Indian. So just really kind of spanned. But I always identify myself as African American or somebody like, or a Caribbean American. Sometimes I can say I'm Afro-Latina, but it always comes back to being a Black woman or African American, because I definitely, majority of my ancestors are displaced Africans. So that's whether they're Spanish speaking or English speaking. And so that's kind of, I love having my background because I feel like it's kind of opened me up. And, you know, I just always was like, you know, had imbued with different cultures, like, you know, having the Danish Jewish grandparent, I just, you know, tended to know a lot about cultures and always kind of, just made me really kind of interesting, and not only learning about my background, but learning about other people's cultures. So my whole part, I didn't say, like, my undergraduate was actually international politics. Again, it was kind of that, like, really interested in global affairs, what's going on in the world, loving history. And I had all intentions on being a foreign service officer. But then I got the journalism and television and film bug and decided to follow that path. And I lucked out and met the love of my life, who also wanted to be a foreign service officer. So I got the best of both worlds. I got to stay in my career that I loved. And I also got to live overseas with him. And yeah, we lived in a lot of great countries. My daughter was born in Prague. My son was born in London. We've lived in a couple of places in Latin America. I met one of my best friends in Mexico, who I'm talking to right now. So, you know, it's been like an incredible 24 years. Matter of fact, we just got married. We got married a week ago, 24 years ago. And I think the journey started in November of 1996. So,
well, happy anniversary.
Thank you. Yeah.
And it was Mexico City where you and I met. I think that was Douglas, your husband's very first foreign post. Is that right?
Yeah. It was, he got the call the summer of 1996, was in training, and then took off November of 1996. That was his first tour. I think you probably met us a year in.
That's right.
Still still youngins, we were a little past middle school, but it's been an incredible journey. And
this is making really me think that a future podcast is going to be just recounting adventures of living abroad, and especially living in a community, the bubble of being part of an embassy, and also really some of the things that are unique about being a spouse in that setting, because there are some protocols that I certainly wasn't aware of when we did this. But anyway, that's for another.
Oh yeah. And that was actually my thesis dissertation. It was on adjustment of spouses. And it happened during when we were living in Honduras, and it was an interesting time there. So it's been an incredible experience. Some ups and downs, but mostly ups. And yeah, that's definitely a conversation. I always think they're great stories and funny stories. I don't know if everybody would think they're funny, but I think some people would. So we should definitely talk about it.
Right. For a future one. Another thing that I wanted to point out, and I know we've got a couple of specific questions to get to, but this is just so fun and fascinating. But one of the things that I love about the way you explain your career is, you know, you got a bug early in life. First, you know, you started down this political path or this foreign affairs path, international path. Then you realized, wow, television is really my passion. And you did, you know, you worked at different places, had wonderful jobs there. And then you realized that, you know, it was a different calling. And the reason that I'm saying this is, you know, to our young listeners out there, especially women, and especially women of color, this is something that I remember being at a lawyers, the Hispanic National Bar Association had at a conference, this kind of a speed dating thing, but it was speed mentoring. And so, you know, we mentors, the older ones would sort of sit in one place because, you know, we were too old and decrepit to actually move. And the youngins were sort of, you know, would sort of rotate. And it became so clear to me that they were all, on the one hand, super eager and ambitious, and boy, they had their career path mapped out in a much more detailed way than I ever did at their age. But they were also impatient and a little bit like down on themselves if they hadn't achieved what they thought they should have by age, you know, 28. And I started saying to them, the cliche is that life is short, but I'm here to tell you, as someone who's been doing what I do for nearly 30 years, that your career is long. And, you know, you may not achieve exactly what you think that you want in a year or two, but it's a long time. And I'm here to tell you, just like you, Rochelle, I have switched careers. You know, I kind of pathed in three different pivots. You don't know. And so I just wanted to point that out, because I think that hearing, if I were a young woman today who you know, maybe had been in any of the fields that you and I have been in, I would be inspired to know that, you know, enjoy this moment, do what I'm doing right now to the best way I can. And who knows what the future holds.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you would have told me at 28, that I would be doing this work, I would have just been like, are you kidding me? I was like Miss Television. I was just really, you know, I was in producing, just really, you know, I just finished getting my master's in media studies in television and film. And yeah, you would have never told me, but I was working on a lot of health documentaries. I guess this was like probably mid-90s, and I just really loved the topics. And so I said, I'm going to take a course on this because I'm really interested in psychology. And then I took a class in psychology, and I was like, I really think I might get a master's in this because I really, really love this. I love the research. I love trying to understand. I always said journalism and psychology, the two things that link them is being curious about people. And so it kind of was a natural fit for me. And that master's turned into the doctorate. And then that's how the life started. So it wasn't something intentional, but you can definitely see a path how it was going. And now if I look back on it with all the work that I do on, you know, research and writing articles and doing webinars and other media, I'm using my skills from television, putting together a story for people, and just kind of having that like investigative skills that I developed. So, you know, it kind of all develops. Yeah. And you can't, it's so hard with all life changes. And, you know, I have to, let me back up a little bit. I think I also, and I don't know if you feel like this too, Patty, that I'm really grateful that I was able to pivot. I was really grateful that I was able to go back to school, and not only go back to school, but I did my doctorate in 3 different countries. Wow. So imagine if I decided to do this in the 80s or 90s, I would not have been able to do that like I did when I was doing this from like 2006 to 2012. We just didn't have that technology. So just it's incredible the time we're born in to be able to do that.
Right, right. Well, and it's just so fascinating that you give that trajectory, because what I often say, given what I ended up doing for a living, is that rather than getting a JD, rather than getting a law degree, I probably should have gotten a PhD in psychology, because that is my passion, is exactly what you said, figuring people out, human motivation, human behavior. Why do people do certain things? You know, how can we maybe effectuate some level of deeper understanding and maybe some behavioral change and impact on that? And so I have the same through line, even though people would not connect starting out as a lawyer, even though it was an employment lawyer, to where I am now, it's very clear to me, why I didn't, why being a litigator was not my cup of tea, because it didn't allow me to explore those, you know, those parts of it. But the through line then is I became a workplace investigator, which, you know, there couldn't have been anything that satisfied my curiosity, my thirst for getting to know people, putting a puzzle together, you know, more than that. And then frankly, after I did, you know, thousands of those, I thought, well, what can I what learning lessons can I take from this body of work that I've done, which frankly, I didn't know it at the time, but I see it now, was research. You know, even though I was actually working in the moment to solve some problems, I was collecting data and data points and points in time that ended up being, you know, research that really helped me along the way. So anyway, this was not even something that we had talked about.
But
it's fascinating.
I just thought of another webinar talking about portable transferable skills.
Exactly. And how much as much as I personally really disliked being a litigator, I can tell you now, decades later, how both my legal education and the work that I did do as a litigator has been a key, you know, to me being able to successfully do what I do now. So I've been running away from that for a long time, and I finally realized that, you know, it's not all bad. So all of this, the reason that I'm getting a little bit off topic is because it's really not the series that we're in right now is talking about intersectionality. Talking about in the last episode, if you didn't hear it, you know, you can go back and learn a little bit more about the actual definition, some of the research that Professor Kimberly Crenshaw conducted, really looking at the fact that when you are a person who is juggling multiple characteristics, trying to look at them through the myopic lens of just one or the other is impossible. So I am not just a woman. I am not just an immigrant. I am not just a Latina. I am not just a mom. I am not just a person who grew up in the inner city. I'm all those things, and I can't, you know, separate them. And so that's really what I want to talk about. And so just so the audience knows, Rochelle and I are actually going to be talking over a series of episodes. And what we're really going to be covering today is getting deeper into that issue of intersectionality. So in the last podcast episode, I really focused just because it was perfect timing, but also sad timing that it coincided with Latina Equal Pay Day. And so an element of intersectionality that, is really a hot topic and something that we need to elevate so that we can conquer it is that an effective intersectionality is unequal pay. And sadly, as I reported during the last episode, Latinas are at the very bottom of that pay scale and end up getting paid the lowest of all women of color and population at large. So what I want to cover today is really digging a little bit deeper and going beyond just the pay inequity, but what are the other ways that these intersections, and again, especially when we're looking at the intersection of race and ethnicity and gender, I really want to explore based on not just your personal experience, but your professional experience, what some of the other ways in which those inequities manifest in life and in the workplace.
Yeah, well, that's Thank you, Patty. It's a really big topic. You know, when we look at intersectionality, in a way, it's double discrimination, or it could be triple or quadruple, because we're just, you know, there's a lot of different otherness, that different roles that we can take. It could be, we're talking, you know, racism, sexism, it could be religious oppression. It could be heterosexualism. It could be classism, ageism, ableism, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that we can, you know, discriminate against various people. And I think a lot of the times we have to think about, there's a lot of different biases that come into play when we are at work. You know, we can start with talking about, you know, looking at how we look at ourselves in the mirror and how we come in. And there's like, I don't know if you've ever heard of Beverly Tatum, Professor Beverly Tatum.
I haven't.
Oh, she's amazing. She wrote the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria?
Yes.
Yeah. So she kind of quotes, it's really good, like Cooley. And we've actually always comes up this concept in psychology classes about the looking glass self. Like, we kind of see our identity, but really our identity is kind of based on how others see us. So this is how we're going into the world. And, you know, we're going into a room and, you know, you see, oh, okay, I'm, you know, educated, I'm a lawyer, I'm a psychologist, and this is how I identify myself. And then we go into the office and they're like, oh, there's a female woman of Latino descent, a Black woman coming into the office. And then all of a sudden, that's how our identity is shaped by somebody else. Now, to go into it, I think, you know, when we start thinking about biases and, you know, we can kind of look at it in a neuroscience kind of way and go, we make snap decisions, right? Now, snap decisions is good in a way. It was really great for evolutionary purposes. Like, we know, oh, quick, I see something like a lion. I know that's dangerous. I don't have to think, oh, is that lion coming for me? Or, you know, just like, you know, sniffing around. I know a lion's dangerous, and I'm going to move really quickly. So a lot of these, like a lot of our decisions, unfortunately, aren't made, you know, just aren't, like, we are not thought out. So I think for a lot of people going into the office, there's an affinity bias coming in, where we're drawn to people who look and seem like us. Now, is that fair? No, because, you know, as a person of color and as a woman, there's a lot less people who look like us in the corporate world or any kind of company. So we get less support from managers, because if we're going by that theory, you know, people are going to gravitate to people who look like them. We're also going to have less access to senior leaders, right? Because there's not that many senior leaders who are people of color. And we're also going to be, because of this, we're going to be promoted more slowly. So, you know, this is where you can't stand up for yourself. You're passed over. You may not get that promotion because you didn't particularly click with the manager, because they don't see you as being similar or having a similar sense of humor or a similar life context to be in. So, I mean, that's a pretty overarching, way that's how it comes into the workplace. So I think we kind of just need to dig down on what some of the issues are with what we've both seen in our work, because it's such a big topic to kind of dive down on some of these issues, like some of the biases that come up. You know, is it, you know, we can talk about, you know, just kind of like being, you know, like having to deal with otherness, or, you know, if we start looking into dominant subordinate theory. But, you know, that's all theoretical, but, you know, how does it come, like the experiences of women like us, like, how does it, like, you know, like, I think sometimes we can all get very academic, but just really hearing the stories from other people and going, oh, wow, that was what was happening is really, right, like, okay, so that is a trend. Huh, okay, that possibly could be happening. So
right, right. And I, you know, I think that one of the, I've got listeners who are in leadership positions who maybe are looking for some strategies and ways that they might be able to identify and then, you know, disrupt those biases that, you know, they say, and I certainly believe are implicit, are unconscious, are not, you know, things that they are doing on purpose. And you know, something that I will ask people often is just kind of keep track of things. So, you know, look at who's being interviewed or who you are interviewing. First of all, is that even a diverse slate of people that you're interviewing? But then look at who you ultimately hire. And even if it's not something that you're doing on purpose, if you continue to hire people who are, you know, sort of like you in many ways, then that affinity bias is kicking in. I have a story that I told in my book that is sort of a combination of affinity bias and confirmation bias. And it's a real life story. I renamed the guy Fred. You know, this person says that he needs somebody with very specific experience, interviews a whole slate of people who have varying degrees of experience in this particular field, rejects all of them and says they just don't have the right experience. And in that pool was included a lot of women and a lot of people of color. Lo and behold, a you know, guy who's just like him, I rename him Jeremy, who's sort of a younger version of him, has just graduated from school 2 years prior, has zero experience, frankly, at all, but definitely not the specialized experience that Fred is looking for. But during his interview, apparently Jeremy says that he recognizes he doesn't have experience, but he's going to give it 110%. And based on that, Fred makes the recommendation that, you know, this guy is the perfect person for the job because, again, recognizing he didn't have the experience, but he promised to give it 110%. And I've used this, you know, this story, this real life story. Mm-hmm. Number one, there's the affinity component because, you know, Fred was like, God, this guy reminds me of a younger version of me. There's the confirmation component, which is, well, I'm just going to, what I'm really looking for is somebody who resonates with me. I'm going to use whatever excuse to kind of, you know, justify that this is the right person, even if it's completely hypocritical, you know, where on the one hand, it was used as a reason to dismiss people, but then on the other hand, it was used as a reason to hire someone. But then the third reason that I use it is because I am so obsessed, frankly, with authenticity and consistency, that this was an organization that, you know, talked a lot about how committed they were to diversity and inclusion. And yet when push came to shove, the Jeremy character was of course hired. And what happened as a result in real life was that almost every single diverse person who worked at that location ended up leaving within about a year, in large part because they saw this lack of authenticity. So the cycle of, you know, a real life example of so many things that you're talking about. And if you're a woman of color in that situation, what you say to yourself, and I've heard employee after employee say this, you know, to me in interviews and focus groups and surveys, how am I going to ever get a fair shot when clearly the Jeremys of the world are brought in here, despite the fact that we talk about equity and inclusion, you know, I would have never been given this job. In fact, Fred had an opportunity to hire people who look like me and made excuses not to do so. So it's just, you know, a real life story just really that brings to life everything that you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think I can't remember if I was listening, I read this in the Lean In report. But I mean, that makes total sense. They found that men tend to be measured on what they can do in the future, like their potential, and women and people of color are measured on what they did in the past.
Right.
So, I mean, that's kind of when we look at, you know, women apply for jobs or leadership jobs when they think they have 100% of the qualifications, but men apply for it if they have 60%, because they're like, well, I can do that.
Right.
And so a colleague and I, Dr. Lori Sousa and I were like, okay, how do we start thinking like dudes? And, you know, like, how do we start researching how we can and think, you know, like what our potential is? So that's like, I think that's one hurdle for women, especially women of color, to try to overcome. It's like, what is our potential? Like, how can we sell ourselves with that? I think also, you know, some of the other issues that come up is that the word diversity, and I know you've brought this up before in your past, but is it diversity or is it inclusion? Is it diversity or is it tokenism? Is it, I have a few people of color here, but what positions are they in? So I think that's what leaders first kind of ask themselves, like, is this a real authentic representation of everybody here? Also,
you know what, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to add to that, because it's something that a lot of the clients that I've been talking to have been talking about just in that one area. And that is it accidental diversity or is it intentional diversity? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, might you look at your ranks and think, well, yeah, we've got a couple of, you know, these types of people and a couple of these types of people who just happen to apply and they happen to work here, versus are we intentionally doing something? Do we actually have a plan in place, a strategy in place where this is part of the core of our business model? So that's another one I just wanted to add in, because I've heard that a lot. It's like, yeah, we might have accidental diversity, but that's not what we want.
You know, actually, another way, it was a really good way of describing the difference between diversity and inclusion, is from the Attaway Group. They say, you know, basically diversion is scale, is how can you measure something, where inclusion is how you feel. Do you feel like you're included? So it's like a numbers versus like a real, like, embodied sense of, you know, I belong here, I'm made to feel like I belong here, I'm given the same opportunities.
Right. I can succeed here.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I thought. And, you know, so that's kind of looking at pay inequity, because, and this is a problem with pay histories. It's, again, you know, if people are making sense to the dollar, and then the whole, like, their whole lifespan, they're getting paid like based on that lower pay. How are we ever going to have equity in pay? Inclusion versus, you know, assimilation. And we're going to talk about this, I think, in the next episode. But, you know, how do we, you know, are we allowed to be our own selves? Are we allowed to talk about being mothers? Are we allowed to fully be our authentic selves and work? You know, and then we're dealing with microaggressions. And then do you speak up, you know, about it? And then burnout, which, again, I know we're going to get into that later too. So this is some of the, I mean, you know, if I was going to like do a broad stroke of some of the issues of dealing with that intersectionality, that's, I think, some of the main, and I'm sure other people would probably chime in and say there's some other issues there, but those are, like, I think, if I was going to encapsulate five issues, those are the main topics that I think people are dealing with.
Right, right. Yeah. And we'll have a chance to break some of those down a little bit more in future episodes, not just in this series, but I'm sure that we'll continue to talk about it. And in fact, you know, one thing I guess I'll ask the listeners to do is, you know, feel free to communicate with us if we're putting a series of webinars together, webinar ideas for next year, you know, ways in which we can talk about this even more. So certainly if there are of this great list that Rochelle has just kind of articulated for us, you know, what are the ones that maybe are of most interest to you? So I do want to talk a little bit about that issue of authenticity in two ways. First, just, you know, and this is the type of research that you do, but a lot of people are familiar with the term double bind, where it tends to look at it, again, just from the narrow lens of just gender. You know, so as women, we have to be likable because otherwise we are angry, but we can't be too likable because then we're not really competent. You know, this is magnified when you are a woman of color, because you not only become angry, but you become the angry Black woman. You are not only, you know, wanting to advocate for yourself, but you become aggressive and not a team player if you are a Latina woman or an Asian woman, you know, who about whom there are stereotypes that people expect you to fit into. So there's another kind of exponential way in which that double bind manifests. And I'm curious just if you can tell me a little bit more about how that then plays into this idea of authenticity, this idea of being able to actually come to work, and this is the inclusion piece, this is the belonging piece, you know, how safe and comfortable do I feel? And do I sense that if I do bring my entire self to work, it's not going to have a negative impact? If I do talk about all these other things, you know, I'll add, in addition to the two of us being moms, and I do think that this has a very cultural component to it. And again, it's one of the reasons that you and I have a strong friendship. In both of our cases, our mothers live with us and we are their caretakers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting to me because you and I are one of the only ones, you know, that I know for whom that is just natural and normal. Like, we take care of our moms. But that adds another element that is not part of the dominant culture. And, you know, I'm at the point in my career where not only do I feel comfortable and I have the freedom to talk about these things that are higher priority in my life, frankly, than my career, but I also do it. I take a very affirmative stance on this, and I talk mm-hmm. about it because I want to give other younger women the role modeling for them to be able to say that. And so when, you know, several years ago, my mother had a stroke and I was working as a shareholder in a law firm, I was very clear with people. I'm out. I'm going to go spend the night with my mom. I'm, you know, this is my entire life right now is handling her healthcare situation. I also had a high schooler at the time. And there was no, you know, I was in the position to be able to talk about that very freely. And again, I did it in part so that younger employees in general, but especially women and especially women of color, could say, oh, that's possible to kind of, you know, articulate that. So talk to me about, you know, from your perspective, again, both individually, but also from your professional background, that authenticity piece.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I was like, sandwich generation. That's another webinar.
Exactly.
So let's start with the whole double bind, which, interestingly enough, do you know in the 40s and 50s, they used to think the double bind caused schizophrenia?
No. Whoa.
Yeah. Lots of theories back in the day, Bateson and all this other stuff. It doesn't, but it can definitely make you a little nuts, though, I think, for most of us, because the double bind in this case is you have to be likable, but not too likable. So, you know, doesn't sound too hard, but it is, and it's not really authentic. And there's tons and tons of studies on mental health when you're just not being able to act like simply just like yourself, and you're kind of having to tuck away part of your being, is definitely going to cause, you know, definitely will, you know, is a pathway to depression and anxiety. And so, you know, we'll go more into mental health later, but I just kind of wanted to bring that up. And for women of color, the double bind is even stronger. So, you know, we always kind of think of somebody being, when you hear Patty, when you hear bossy or assertive, you know.
Do you mean at work or my husband?
Yeah. yes, both. You know, when we're saying assertive, if I said Bob is assertive, that's a positive. But if I say Mary is assertive, it sounds really aggressive and unlikable. So the more assertive you are, the less like you are, but you're more effective, right? You know, like, you're considered more effective, which is fine for, you know, if you're a man, that's good. You know, it's like fine, aggressive, assertive, and being
competitive,
you know, effective, great. Yeah. But when you're a woman, you know, obviously people want to be with people they like more. But if you're a woman, you're liked, you're not seen as assertive and not seen as effective. So that's the double bind. It's kind of the damn if you do, damn if you don't. So right. It's kind of hard to, it's like always kind of trying to balance, be on a balancing beam. And I don't know about you, but I have poor balance. So I was like falling over and all this other stuff. And, you know, one, I forgot what year it came up with, but somebody wrote a study, Kesha Thomas and a few other people, calling going from pet to threat. And that's, you know, when you're hired.
I love me a rhyme.
I know. I was like, from pet to threat. I wish I thought of that myself. Because, you know, when you're brought in and you're like, oh, great, we're, you know, have, this is like diverse and, you know,
so excited to have you here.
So excited. You're really competent and everything. But then, you know, you start giving your opinion or you seem a little too confident and everything. That's when you go to threat. And I think that's where a lot of people, that disconnect happens for a lot of people. Like, what happened? I was like recruited. I came in. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm not going to meetings that I should be going to or not included in or, you know, not is that shiny new penny anymore. And right. So that I just kind of like think that's a really interesting because I think you get a penalty regardless when you assert yourself. And then, you know, and then if you kind of speak up for yourself or are not always happy. I know some people, I know some executives will talk about, you know, I can't ever seem angry. I always have to seem happy. So again, you're putting on this kind of false self, this kind of, you know, in a way, I mean, I see I'm getting into my existential roots, but this kind of, you know, this persona, this false self that you're, you know, and you have to a degree, you can't be 100% for real, right? Because then you'll never get anybody to like you, but, or take you seriously.
Right.
But to have to do that, you know, for 100, like for 80% or 30% of your real self to kind of be masked, you know, that's like
it's
real
exhausting.
Negative consequences. Yeah, it's exhausting and real negative consequences.
Right, right.
And especially if you want to put food on the table, you know, it's just, you know, it's sure. kind of hard. So, sure.
And I think one of the points that you make is also really important. I mean, we do have different versions of ourselves. I always, one of the shorthand ways that I put it, not that I do this anymore, but back in the day, you know, there was the bachelorette party in Vegas, Patty. I mean, that woman used to exist. She doesn't anymore, but she used to exist. And that was an authentic part of myself. And that's not who I bring to work. I mean, we're certainly not implying that you are going to be, you know, unprofessional or that there's the exact same persona. But I think that you've just articulated it so well in saying, while we're not saying that, of course, there are going to be some changes that all of us make, irrespective of characteristics that we might, you know, need to conform with behavioral standards in a workplace. But when the way in which you have to manipulate your personality, the way in which you have to manipulate the way that you behave is so severe and stark that you're having to twist yourself into a new person. That's, I think, when the exhaustion really does kick in. So, you know, we're going to be covering a lot of this in future episodes. I wanted to just end this episode with kind of a preview for what we're going to be talking about next time. So in next episode, we're going to be talking a lot about how does one other element of intersectionality come in? So we've talked about certain characteristics, but now we're going to put it in the context of where we are right now, in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of some real health inequities that are being unearthed, or at least people are discovering about them. It's not that they haven't existed; it's that maybe people weren't paying attention to them. We're in the middle of, you know, sort of a new era in terms of people looking at the issue of racial inequity in just a whole new way. We just had an election, which was incredibly contentious, to say the least. I mean, all this is going on. And so we want to talk about the way in which those have also, you know, had a disproportionate effect on those of us who are at that intersection of characteristics, but then also provide some practical ways in which, you know, we can maybe deal with them, especially, unfortunately, since we're recording this in November of 2020. And, you know, it does not look like the pandemic is going to end anytime soon. And indeed, our numbers are getting scarier and scarier. So I just want to end with kind of a segue that you and I had talked about, which is a lot of talk. We've been hearing a lot of talk about one of the effects of the pandemic, one of the effects of those of us who are privileged enough to be able to work from home. Now, might have children at home, for example, who are remote learning. We suddenly have to become, you know, teachers in addition to bearing the brunt of housework. We have to be the emotional healers. We have to be, I know during the beginning of the pandemic, I called myself chief entertainment officer. You know, I was the one who had to buy the puzzles and you know, it was fine. I was also the family shopper, you know, and the cook and the cleaner. So to end this episode and really be able to segue into the next one, give me a little bit more flavor on how that has affected things, that the fact that women, and I would say definitely women of color, even to a greater extent, have taken on all these other responsibilities.
Yeah. Well, I think I talked a little earlier about the mom bias that even starts when you get engaged, right? There's studies that affects you because they're like, okay, you're a young woman, you know, you're getting married, you're going to go on that track. And I think the pandemic has definitely highlighted the inequity between women and class and race during this time. And I know it's like such a big topic, but study upon study, just talking to people, like anecdotes and just doing research, is like how much women are dropping out of the workforce because maybe they have like another income coming in if they're married, but they have to drop out of the workforce because they can't balance taking care of their kids and working. And it doesn't really necessarily have to be that way. And so kind of talking it through, like what, you know, where are some of the issues that I think that we can talk about in the next episode, and just kind of pinpointing like, why is this happening? Why is this phenomena happening? And, you know, also like the best way I can sum it up, when somebody I haven't talked to or somebody who lives in another country and they ask me how I'm doing, and I'm like, well, besides the pandemic, social and racial injustices and protest and the election, I'm doing fine. So, you know, that's something.
Right. You know, yeah. Three minor things going on.
Just three little things. But I think it's, you know, it's talking about these issues, putting it out on the table, and not to put the onus on the person who is dealing with these issues. Because I think sometimes when we go, oh, self-care, you know, we then take the responsibility from the institution. But I think we also need to look at it as like, how do we protect ourselves? How do we provide scaffolding for each other while we try to get these real systemic changes made?
Right. Right.
That's
and just, we've got to address it on both
little
fronts.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, I mean, a little thing there.
A big theme that I have, and you know, I have keynotes that I make about this, and I think I've talked about it before on the podcast, is a real theme for me, especially again when I'm talking to young women of color, is the absolute vital need that we each have individually to find our voices and then to use our voices. But it won't work if we don't, in the workplace, also get the system to be more welcoming to some of the concerns that we have, and leaders, individual leaders, to sort of, you know, be open to and understand these things. And so you've got to address it all together. So that's a preview. We are going to be covering, you know, how, again, that's all of this is manifesting. The issues of intersectionality are manifesting within the confines of, you know, where we find ourselves in the world. But for today, I think it is obvious that not only am I good friends with Rochelle because of her humor and her insight and her life philosophies, but she is brilliant. And so that obviously came out today. And it will continue to come out, I know. But for today's episode, Dr. Johnson, I am thrilled to have had you on as my guest, and I look forward to talking to you next time.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Patty. It was great. And I look forward to the next podcast. So I will see you then.
All right.